Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 171 of CJ Evolution. Pat Fitzgibbons here, the host and creator of the show, whatever you were doing, wherever you were at. Thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. Special thanks for all the first responders out there, brave men and women serving in the criminal justice field in various capacities. Thank you so much for what you're doing. You have much support out there. Believe it or not, you have tons of support doing a very dangerous job in a very dangerous environment. In fact, my next guest, Elliot Spector, is amazing. He is an advocate for law enforcement. He's an advisor. He represents law enforcement officers, and he wrote an amazing book called Beyond Black Lives Matter, Building Trust Through Knowledge and Understanding. I give you the one, the only Elliot Spector. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Elliot Spector on the show. If you don't know who Elliot is, his practice concentrates on the representation of law enforcement officers and municipalities. He also acts as a law enforcement advisor for police departments and individual officers on policy issues, critical incidents, and law-related questions. Elliot Spector, welcome, sir. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, I appreciate it. Now, you're in Connecticut. How's the weather out there?
It's cold, but it's getting warmer. And fortunately, we're going to have some rain and wash away all the snow pretty soon.
Yeah, it's weird. I have friends out in Alabama, which is supposed to be warm. Now they're having record lows. And here in Colorado, it's like 60.
Ah, nice. I think we're going to get your weather pretty soon.
Well, I gave a little bit of an intro, sir, a little bit of your background. Can you elaborate a little bit more on your background for us?
Sure. I joined the Hartford Police Department in 1971 and stayed there for 9 years until 1980. And the reason I joined the department is relevant to the topic of my book. Mm-hmm. I grew up during the era of John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country.
Excellent. Yeah.
And a number of years later, I find myself in college where we have the civil rights and the Vietnamese protests. And we see the police officers on television allegedly beating the protesters unmercifully. And the way the media portrayed them was as bad people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, listening to John F. Kennedy, I said, well, what can I do to help my country? And I thought about the Peace Corps, and I thought about maybe I should be a social worker. And then I said, well, you know, maybe I'll be a police officer, because if I'm a police officer, there'll be one less bad officer out there. Mm-hmm. And when I joined the Hartford Police Department, I learned very quickly that I was an idiot, that I was ignorant, that I didn't know what police officers were really like, that they were all good people. They just wanted to help others, do a good job, protect citizens. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the major problem that we have here, is that people like me who were from, I suppose you could call us the liberal left activists, we're ignorant as to the realities of policing. Mm-hmm. Well, while I was a police officer, I got a second degree in foreign language studies so I could speak Spanish to the citizens of Hartford. And then I got a law degree. And after getting a law degree, I started to practice law representing police officers, as you indicated in the introduction, mm-hmm. doing policy work for police departments and working on projects for a lot of federal government agencies, Department of Justice, the FBI, DEA, spoken on a number of conferences, write extensively. And I think I'm most proud of the fact that for the last approximately 30 years, I have updated the Connecticut Law Enforcement Field Manual, which is carried by all of our police officers.
Amazing. And well, thank you for your service, sir. And I imagine, I mean, it goes without question, policing was a heck of a lot different when you were in the field than it is now. I mean, you've seen the differences.
Oh, it's absolutely different. I mean, I really love being a police officer. Of all the things I've done in life, I like that the most, because you virtually get to help people every single day you're out there. And it's exciting. It's interesting work. Police officers have experiences in a month that many people don't have in a lifetime.
Sure. And were you going through law school when you were still a police officer or what?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God. That must have been brutal.
Well, they were nice enough for the last couple of years to let me work the midnight shift.
So that you had – maybe it was a little slow and you had time to study and –
Yeah, after 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, things do slow down.
Well, can you tell us, sir, you're also involved in the Spector Criminal Justice Training Network, which is just an amazing resource and education for law enforcement. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We started up in the 1960s, long before I was involved in any law enforcement thing, obviously, by Judge Milton Fishman. And it's a 501c3 nonprofit that was initiated under a federal grant at the time to train police officers in constitutional policing. When Judge Fishman died, unfortunately, in the mid-1980s, I was training for him. I took over the foundation. My training administrator changed the name because people didn't know what the Criminal Law Foundation was. They thought we represented criminals, which we don't. Mm-hmm. And so she said, well, they know who you are, Elliot, so let's change the name to the Specter Criminal Justice Training Network, and we did. But we provide training to well over 1,000 police officers every year, and we do certified classroom training in almost every topic you can think of, mm-hmm. all the legal topics, use of force, domestic violence, handling juveniles, handling emotionally disturbed persons, bias, and just about anything you can think of.
It's amazing. Now, what do you think, and this probably is a good segue into your book, because I want to spend a lot of time talking about your book, which is amazing, by the way. I read it, and I encourage everybody else to read it, too. What do you think some of the challenges facing law enforcement are, and what do you think they're going to be in the future?
Well, it's kind of consistent with why I wrote the book. I think that the most important thing law enforcement officers have to deal with now is overcoming the attack on law enforcement, mm-hmm. rebuilding the trust and respect, you know, getting back to where we were or close to where we were before, where the community respected police and worked with police officers. Mm-hmm. And going forward, I think we have to encourage all good and honest citizens to work with the police to make a safer and healthier community for us all.
And why do you think there's so much misinformation, Elliot? And I know you talk about this in your book, which is Beyond Black Lives Matter, by the way, Building Trust Through Knowledge and Understanding. Again, excellent book. There's so many issues out there and so much misinformation that the public gets. Some of it accurate, as you know, but a lot of it is just misinformation. And why do people just gobble this up?
Well, people are listening to mostly the rhetoric mm-hmm. and the verbal unsubstantiated attacks on police officer, which don't have any substance. And that's why I tried to, in the book, deal with facts and statistics. And I tried to use sources that were not pro-police sources, but most of my sources are at kind of anti-bias police publications, as well as government resources mm-hmm. on statistical information, which I hope is somewhat credible.
Yeah, it's just, I was just looking at the book again, and again, I love how you talk about, you know, the myths and misconceptions out there about what people are hearing and what actually is going on, like, you know, law enforcement. I don't think any police officer out there, and I know you think this, Elliot, gets up in the morning, kisses, you know, his wife goodbye, and goes out there with the intention of shooting somebody.
Police officers obviously don't want to do that. Police officers want to have a nice, calm, quiet, and safe day, just like anyone else that goes to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's amazing that some people, I mean, I teach occasionally. I used to teach more, but it amazes me how many people out there actually think that officers are just out there hunting people down, shooting people at will.
I would certainly hope people wouldn't believe that. And I really think that the people that are speaking out against police are truly an extreme minority. I believe that most people still trust police officers and believe in police officers. But there are a lot of people who are actually intelligent people who are affected by the media events that are going on. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of their bias comes out against police officers. And this is particularly true in the judicial system, where we're finding now that there's more liability cases because the people that are in claims that are paying on these cases, the judges that are sitting on benches, they're human beings and they listen to the media events and they're influenced, unfortunately.
Now, what do you think the real role and responsibility of the media is in today's emotionally charged society?
I think they should be honest and accurate and talk about the true issues that are going on. They should look at the real facts that are going on, particularly with regard to use of force incidents when we're talking about police shootings. Unfortunately, what the media does very often is they cover the protests, they cover the attacks on police officers, and they don't look at why these incidents are occurring. And I think it's most important that they go back to the background and discover, you know, why did a police officer have to use the force mm-hmm. that he did? And that's something that's missing.
Yeah. And you know as well as I do, sir, that there are bad police shootings out there. I'm not saying I know you're not, but for the listener out there, you know, not every police shooting is going to be A-OK, and a prosecutor is going to say, oh, yeah, there are some bad police shootings out there. The one in, I think it was North Carolina or South Carolina, the guy shoots the guy in the back. You probably heard about that or saw that one. So not every shooting out there is going to be a good shooting, but I believe the overwhelming majority of police-involved shootings are justified.
Well, the very fact that you had to go back to the Scott shooting in South Carolina, mm-hmm. and very often people still go back to Rodney King, which happened so many years ago, mm-hmm. shows how rare
exactly.
police excessive force and brutality is, and particularly how rare bad police shootings are. If you look deeply into the summaries given by the Washington Post and the Guardian, who have tracked police shootings since January 1st, 2015, you find that almost all of the shootings are people who are violent, dangerous, and armed criminals. And I would say if you really, really carve down into the facts of these cases, you would see that probably 99.9% of shootings are justified and lawful.
And the thing that really is interesting to me, LA, and I know you've seen and heard this before, is this misconception out there with some, not all, that maybe why did the officer shoot the suspect? All he had was a knife, or why didn't the officer shoot the suspect in the leg, or shoot the knife out of the weapon out of the hand of the suspect? it's just amazing to me. That's not reality. That's Hollywood. That's not real life.
No, there are a lot of myths about police shootings. Mm-hmm. They start off with why would a police officer ever shoot an unarmed person? If you look at the summaries of the cases where unarmed people are shot, you see that these people are posing a risk of serious physical injury or death to police officers or others. You'll have cases like a police officer is literally being drowned by someone, sticks his head up out the water and shoots the individual. A police officer is fighting with someone on a second floor porch and he's about to lose consciousness and he's leaning against the railing. Police officers are injured and killed by unarmed people. There are hundreds of people that die every year because they're assaulted by unarmed people. Just because someone's unarmed doesn't mean he's not dangerous. Mm-hmm. You have people who say that police officers shouldn't shoot to kill people. And the reality is they don't shoot to kill people. They shoot to stop the threat. Mm-hmm. When an individual is coming at a police officer with a knife, or a gun, or a stick, or even going to beat someone severely and cause serious physical injury, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that a police officer has a right and a duty to use deadly force to prevent the risk of serious injury or harm to others. Mm-hmm. And they do so, and they have to do so by shooting someone in body mass to stop the individual. That's the only effective way you can do it.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to talk about some of the other myths, police officers shouldn't shoot people in the back. And in the reality of the situation is if someone has a gun and is, let's say, running away from a police officer, as happened in Chicago last year, that person can turn and fire a gun immediately at the police officer who won't have the opportunity to defend himself. Mm-hmm. In fact, in that particular case, when the individual officer was cleared by the prosecutor, the prosecutor showed a video of a prior real case that happened in Chicago where an individual did not even turn with the gun. He just merely pointed the gun behind his body while he was running mm-hmm. in full stride and literally shot the police officer. We're talking about, why do police officers shoot people so many times? The U.S. Supreme Court in the Plumhoff case addressed that issue. The reason is you shoot until you stop the threat. Mm-hmm. And the number of shots is irrelevant to the reasonableness of an officer's use of force. The question is, were the shots fired while the risk was still present? Mm-hmm. Some people complain about police officers shooting people in motor vehicles, and these people are unarmed. Well, a motor vehicle can cause serious injury or death to people, and I think everybody should realize that. And there are four U.S. Supreme Court cases that have sanctioned police officers shooting people who are posing a risk of serious harm to police officers or others in motor vehicles. Mm-hmm. So, what I've tried to do in the book is I've tried to explain the law to these people that don't understand the law, don't understand why police officers use deadly force, and use very real statistics and information and the stories as published mostly by the Washington Post and the Guardian.
Now, can you talk a little bit? Most listeners that are going to listen to this know about Graham versus Connor. Can you talk a little bit about that, Elliot?
Graham versus Connor is the case that talks about the reasonableness and use of force. And Graham versus Connor said essentially the effect was that most use of force cases are judged under the Fourth Amendment. And when an officer has to make a split-second decision, they should be given the greatest of latitude. The Tennessee versus Garner was a case that was decided on deadly use of force, and the Graham versus Connor and Tennessee versus Garner cases come together in these deadly use of force shooting analysis, where the police officer has an individual who is posing a risk of serious physical injury or death. That's when the police officer can use deadly force under Tennessee versus Garner. And the police officers in such situations, when you overlap Garner with Graham, says that they have to be given this greatest of latitude because they don't know what's going to happen in a split second. Mm-hmm. I mean, people second guess police officers and say, well, you didn't have to shoot them. But the police officer, in the second that they're making that decision, they don't have the luxury of making that determination. I had a case where a police officer shot someone in the back of the head twice who was on the ground. Mm-hmm. And this individual was firing the weapon from underneath his body. And the case actually went to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the judge said, well, you know, couldn't the officer have shot him in the arm? And I had to explain that the officer had to make this split-second decision. There were five people in the area who could have been hit by this individual. The officer doesn't have the luxury of waiting to see where the bullets are going to go that the person is firing from beneath their body and must stop the person from pulling the trigger on the gun. And the only way you can effectively do it is to shoot the person in the brain or the spine. And that's the reality of policing. It's tragic, but that's the way things are.
You talk about so many important issues in law enforcement, such as officer liability, use of force, search and seizure. Do you think some topics are covered like they need to be in officer training, or as they should be? I have a commander in my department, and I had questions from some new officers the other day. Maybe new officers are always going to have questions, as do veteran officers, but it didn't seem like they understood search and seizure in the Fourth Amendment that much. I mean, do you see that in your encounters?
Well, we have pretty good training out here in Connecticut, and obviously, the level of training, the amount of training, the quality trainer differs a great deal depending on where you are. But the most important topics that I think are lacking in law enforcement are building relationships with the community, probably handling emotionally disturbed people, because 25% of people that are shot by police officers are unfortunately emotionally disturbed. Exactly. And I think the most important thing is helping young people make better life decisions. That issue is fairly much absent from police training. But there's nothing more important that a police officer can do than turn around the life of a young person.
Yeah, I agree. I think community policing and the officers in Colorado and the academies, they hit on it. But as you know, Elliot, there's so much information. You know, it's like drinking from a fire hose when you're near your academy. You know, there's so much information and requirements that the state puts on academies, rightfully so. And I think community policing, in my perspective, they talk about it, they learn about it, but I agree with you, they need to spend more time. And not only that, but like you said, emotional wellness and how to take care of yourself. Because this job, as you know, Elliot, it's very taxing.
Well, you mentioned the Fourth Amendment, how police officers don't fully understand the Fourth Amendment, and that's very unfortunate. But the law does change rapidly. Mm-hmm. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, and officers must be updated constantly on Fourth Amendment issues because it deals with stops, search and seizure, use of force, virtually things that police officers do every single day. So, we have one of these programs where an officer goes in for legal training every 2 years or every 3 years. They're missing a lot of law. Exactly. So I agree with you that these officers must be trained on current law at all times.
Yeah, you hit it. I don't think there's a day that goes by where officers aren't confronted with a Fourth Amendment issue, like you said, whether it's, coming into a house or an apartment or stopping a vehicle. So it's very, very important. I want to shift back on your book, sir, and there's so much information in the book, and I think you talked about some of the things like use of force and officer-involved shooting. What are some other takeaways to the book that you want people to know about?
Well, I have a number of takeaways. Certainly can't go through them all, but
yeah,
I think one of the most important things is countering the mantra of the Black Lives Matter movement that police officers don't care about black lives. And the reality is police officers care about black lives and the lives of all people. You know, the old adage, action speaks louder than words, tells the story here. Police officers respond to millions of calls every single year and save thousands of lives of people, regardless of race or ethnicity. And that's the reality of the situation, that police officers are saving the lives of black people all the time. Mm-hmm. I suppose the second mantra is that police officers are racist and police officers aren't racist. I mean, it's easy for me to say that, but how can we prove it? Well, police officers have interactions with literally hundreds of millions of people every single year. But I would challenge anyone to find judicial rulings, you know, substantiating a racial profiling case against police officers. They are extremely rare. I can tell you in Connecticut, in the history of our little state, and we have obviously numerous municipalities, urban areas, minority areas, you know, we haven't had any, a single one. For approximately 20 plus years, I did the legal update for the legal officer section at the IACP. That's the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And in the last 10 years I did it, I was hard pressed to find any cases in the United States that went to the appellate court where a racial profiling claim was substantiated. We have a number of them dismissed because there's no evidence. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's telling with all the attorneys out there that love to sue police officers.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that there aren't biased police officers out there, but the type of pervasive racism that they claim is there simply isn't there. Another thing that I think is important, if you don't mind me, babbling on here, is the claim that there are a grossly disproportionate number of black males that are shot and killed by police officers. Well, that's really the elephant in the room, because the sad reality is there are a grossly disproportionate number of violent crimes committed by black males. According to the FBI UCR, it's approximately 55% of the robberies, over 50% of the murders and intentional manslaughters, over 37% of the violent crimes that are committed. And it's sad, and that's really tragic. And I think if there's a social injustice that we should address, it's the fact that so many young black males find themselves involved in criminal activity that puts them in a position where they're going to be confronted by a police officer and unfortunately sometimes shot.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Another thing is that officers intentionally shoot and kill innocent people. The reality of the situation is that just does not happen. Not when someone's totally innocent. Even in that terrible case that you talked about, the Scott case that happened several years ago, unfortunately, you know, he was not actually an innocent person. He was someone who had a warrant for him that ran away, that struggled with police officers. It was a bad shooting. It was a clearly bad shooting. There's no question about it. But to think that police officers would go out there and intentionally kill someone just because of their race or ethnicity is just absolutely absurd. I mean, every year there are a few people, unfortunately, who are innocent, who are unintentionally shot, you know, where they're bystanders or they're shot because there's an accidental discharge of a weapon. But, in most cases, police officers intentionally shoot people that they perceive are posing a risk of serious physical injury or death to themselves or others. Yeah. And if someone wanted to take the time and actually go through the Washington Post 2015 narrative of these cases, they would understand what I'm talking about. Of course, there are a few people that are willing to do that. A police officer doesn't care what the color of the hand is that's holding the gun or the knife or other weapon that's attacking themselves or others. And the reality of the situation is when you read these summaries, you say, oh, my God, these police officers are heroes because they're the ones responding to these dangerous circumstances, and they're there to protect the public. Mm-hmm. One other thing I'd like to mention is a lot of people say that police officers are trigger happy. In fact, when you look at these situations, you'll see that officers use great restraint. The FBI, reports that there are approximately 12 million arrests every year. 500,000 of those are violent crimes, and yet very few people relative to those numbers are shot by police officers. When I teach police officers, I have my little informal survey that I do. I ask the people in the class, has anybody shot someone? And, once in a while, we have a couple police officers that raise their hand, sometimes one police officer. Usually no police officers have shot anybody. And then I ask them this question, how many of you could have legally shot someone but chose not to do it? And you see at least 60% of the class raising their hands, including my hand. I mean, even when I was a police officer, I had an occasion in domestic violence call where the woman said her husband was down the cellar, and I opened the cellar door, and there's the guy holding the gun at me. And I drew my gun, and I told him to drop it. And thank God he dropped it, and I did not shoot him. I certainly could have. Mm-hmm. Or a dangerous felon running into a housing project that I said, well, you know, I can legally shoot him, but I'm just not going to. And that's what police officers do. They do not shoot people. And sometimes, unfortunately, police officers are seriously injured or lose their lives because they do use great restraint. Mm-hmm. Can I mention a couple other things?
Oh, go ahead, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize. This is great information, and I'm writing notes as you're talking.
All right. Another thing we hear a lot, and we've heard from politicians and other people, is that young black and brown men have to fear police officers. The reality is they do not. If these young people are taught not to commit crimes, they probably will not have an encounter with police officers. There may be occasions where a police officer might stop them, and it may be annoying, humiliating. They may inconvenience them, but they're certainly not going to hurt them. And if they merely cooperate with the police, there probably isn't going to be any harm that's going to come to these individuals. Mm-hmm. We recently had a case here where I represented an officer a number of weeks ago here in Connecticut, where these three young kids, unfortunately of color, were going around committing carjackings. They shot at a couple of victims. They pistol whipped one victim. And so they were on the lookout for this vehicle. They were on social media showing themselves with a gun. Why would young people do that? And then when the police officers tried to stop them and had them boxed into their vehicles, why would the driver decide to back up and smash a police cruiser? And thereafter, when a police officer gets out of the car and is pointing a gun at him and telling him to get out of the car, why would they drive at the police officer and try to drive away? And unfortunately, the police officers used their firearms and shot mm-hmm. two of these young men. Mm-hmm. And that's a tragedy that we have here, that our young people feel that they can do these things, that they can get away from these things. They feel that they're going to live forever. And we just have to turn that around. I think that's the most important thing that we can do.
Well, and I think a lot of enabling, we hit on it a little bit, Elliot, enabling from certain, you know, media outlets that it's okay. I mean, that they might not come out and say directly, but it's, you know, the undertone is there where, hey, you know, stand up and, you know, disagree with the police and don't, you know, stand your ground. You don't have to do what the police are telling you. And I agree with you 100%. I think some of this goes back on the media. The media has incredible reach, as you know, and young people see this. Maybe not all of them watch the news, but it's there. And I haven't seen it this bad in 21 years as being a cop. But it does seem. And now, thank God, most people are law abiding, but there seems to be this element out there that just says, you know, screw the cops, we're going to do what we want. And I've never seen it before in my career.
Yeah, and I'm not going to encourage anyone to go to the Black Lives Matter website, but I did do it a couple of times. And they actually say to these young people, you don't have to respect police officers. You don't have to do what the police officers say. You don't have to be nice to police officers. And of course, these people that are putting this stuff on the internet, they're not going to have the confrontations. The young people that are listening to them that are going to have the confrontations, they're going to lead, unfortunately, to harm.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one question I had, Elliot, maybe you can answer this. You know, if there is an element out there that is saying all officers are racist and they're trigger happy, what do you say to the fine men and women who are African-American, Latino, that are serving, and others, Asian officers, are they all racist too? I mean, I never understood that. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, as you well know, when you're a police officer, you are not Asian, you're not black, you're not brown, you're not white, you are blue.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the reality. And I think that one of the tragedies here with this attack on police officers is police departments are having more trouble recruiting young people mm-hmm. because they don't think well of being a police officer based on what they're hearing. And it's especially true in the minority communities because we do need more minority officers to join the ranks.
Exactly. Well, Elliot, it has been an education, sir. I want you to talk a little bit more about your book. Where can people go and find your book?
Okay. My book, you can get it on Amazon just like you can get anything else from Amazon. You can also get it from the publisher. That's Loose Leaf Law. And www.looseleaflaw.com. You can get it from them, and Barnes & Noble also has an electronic version of the book.
And you can go to spectretraining.org. That's your...
Yes, you can certainly do that. spectretrainingnetwork@gmail.com is the email. And the website is spectretraining.org, as you mentioned.
Well, Elliot, I thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to come on the show and share your expertise, your experience, and definitely sharing this valuable book that I think everybody has to go out and buy. So thank you, sir. I appreciate you being here.
I very much appreciate your having me on. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.